Mr. Norrell was more perplexed than ever.
I am, of course, sorry that these badly behaved young women have been studying magic. That members of the female sex should study magic at all is, I may say, a thing I am very much opposed to. But I do not quite see...
Mr. Norrell, said Lord Liverpool, these girls were 13. Their parents are adamant that they have never so much as seen a magical text. There are no magicians in Stamford, no magic books of any kind.
Mr. Norrell opened his mouth to say something, realized he was quite at a loss, and fell silent.
Lascelles said, This is very odd.
What explanations did the girls give?
The girls told their parents that they looked down and saw the spell written upon the path in grey pebbles. They said the stones told them what to do. Other people have since examined the path. There are indeed some grey pebbles, but they form no symbols, no mystical writing. They are ordinary grey pebbles.
And you say that there have been other instances of magic in other places, besides Stamford, said Mr. Norrell.
Many other instances, and many other places, mostly, but by no means solely, in the north, and almost all within the past 2 weeks. 17 fairy roads have opened up in Yorkshire. Of course, the roads have existed since the reign of the Raven King, but it's centuries since they actually led anywhere, and the local inhabitants allowed them to become overgrown. Now, without warning, they're clear again. The weeds are gone, and the inhabitants report that they can see strange destinations at the end of them, places no one has ever seen before.
Has anyone... Mr. Norrell paused and licked his lips. Has anyone come down the roads?
Not yet, said Lord Liverpool. But presumably it is only a matter of time.
Lord Sidmouth had been impatient to speak for some moments.
This is worst of all, he declared in a passion. It is one thing to change Spain by magic, Mr. Norrell. This is England. Suddenly we border upon places no one knows anything about, places no one has ever even heard of. I can scarcely describe my feelings at this juncture. It is not treason, exactly. I do not think there is even a name for what you have done.
But I did not do it, said Mr. Norrell in a tone of desperation.
Why would I? I detest fairy roads. I've said so upon many occasions.
He turned to Lord Liverpool.
I appeal to your lordship's memory. Have I ever given you reason to suppose that I approve of fairies or their magic? Have I not censured and condemned them at every turn?
This was the first thing that Mr. Norrell had said that seemed in any way to mollify the Prime Minister. He inclined his head slightly.
But if it is not your doing, whose is it?
This question seemed to strike at some particularly vulnerable spot in Mr. Norrell's soul. He stood, eyes staring, mouth opening and closing, entirely unable to answer. Lascelles, however, was in complete command of himself. He had not the least idea in the world whose magic it was, nor did he care, but he did know precisely what answer would serve his and Mr. Norrell's interest best.
Frankly, I'm surprised that your lordship need put the question, he said coolly. Surely the wickedness of the magic proclaims its author. It is strange.
Strange? Lord Liverpool blinked. But strange is in Venice.
Mr. Norrell believes that strange is no longer the master of his own desires, said Lascelles. He has done all sorts of wicked magic. He has trafficked with creatures that are enemies of Great Britain, of Christianity, of mankind itself. This catastrophe may be some sort of experiment of his which has gone awry, or it may be that he has done it deliberately. I feel only right to remind your lordship that Mr. Norrell has warned the government on several occasions of the great danger to the nation from strangers' present researches. We have sent your lordship urgent messages, but we have received no replies. Fortunately for us all, Mr. Norrell is what he always was, firm, resolute, and watchful.
As he spoke, Lascelles's glance fell upon Mr. Norrell, who was at that moment the very picture of everything which was dismayed, defeated, and impotent. Lord Liverpool turned to Mr. Norrell.
Is this your opinion also, sir?
Mr. Norrell was lost in thought, murmuring over and over,
This is my doing. This is my doing.
Although he spoke to himself, it was just loud enough for everyone else in the room to hear. Lascelles's eyes widened, but he was master of himself in an instant.
It is only natural that you feel that now, sir, he said quickly.
But in a while you will realize that nothing could be further from the truth. When you taught Mr. Strange magic, you could not have known that it would end like this. No one could have known.
Lord Liverpool looked more than a little irritated at this attempt to make Mr. Norrell appear in the character of a victim. For years and years, Mr. Norrell had set himself up as the chief magician in England, and if magic had been done in England, then Lord Liverpool considered him partly responsible at least.
I ask you again, Mr. Norrell. Answer me plainly, if you please. Is it your opinion that this was done by Strange?
Mr. Norrell looked at each gentleman in turn.
Yes,
he said in a frightened voice.
Lord Liverpool gave him a long, hard look. Then he said, The matter shall not rest here, Mr. Norrell, but whether it is Strange or not, one thing is clear. Great Britain already has a mad king. A mad magician will be the outside of enough. You have repeatedly asked for commissions, well, here is one. Prevent your pupil from returning to England.
But, began Mr. Norrell.
Then he caught sight of Lascelles' warning glance and fell silent. Mr. Norrell and Lascelles returned to Hanover Square. Mr. Norrell went immediately to the library. Childermas was working at the table as before.
Quick, cried Mr. Norrell. I need a spell which no longer works.
Childermas shrugged.
There are thousands. Chaunt Lucet?
Footnote 4. Chaunt Lucet, a mysterious and ancient spell which encourages the moon to sing. The song the moon knows is apparently very beautiful and can cure leprosy or madness in any who hear it.
Daedalus's Rose?
Footnote 5. Daedalus's Rose, a fairly complicated procedure devised by Martin Pale for preserving emotions, vices, and virtues in amber or honey or beeswax. When the preserving medium is warmed, the imprisoned qualities are released. The rose has, or rather had, a huge number of applications. It could be used to dispense courage to oneself or inflict cowardice on one's enemy. It could provoke love, lust, nobility of purpose, anger, jealousy, ambition, self-sacrifice, etc., etc.
The Unrobed Ladies.
Footnote 6. Like many spells with unusual names, the Unrobed Ladies was a great deal less exciting than it sounded. The ladies of the title were only a kind of woodland flower which was used in a spell to bind a fairy's powers. The flower was required to be stripped of leaves and petals, hence the unrobing.
Stokes's Vitrification?
Footnote 7. Stokes's Vitrification turns objects and people to glass.
Stokes's Vitrification. Yes, I have a description of that.
Mr. Norrell rushed to a shelf and pulled out a book. He searched for a page, found it, and looked hurriedly around the room. On a table near the fireside stood a vase of mistletoe, ivy, red-berried holly, and some sprays of a winter-flowering shrub. He fixed his eye upon the vase and began to mutter to himself. All the shadows in the room did something odd, something not easy to describe or explain. It was as if they all turned and faced another way. Even when they were motionless again, Childermas and Lascelles would have been hard-pressed to say whether they were the same as they had been or not. Something fell out of the vase and shattered upon the table with a tinkling sound. Lascelles went over to the table and examined it. One of the branches of holly had been turned into glass. The glass branch had been too heavy for the vase, and so it had toppled out. Two or three unbroken holly leaves lay on the table.
That spell has not worked for almost 400 years, said Mr. Norrell. Watership specifically mentions it in A Fairy Wood Withering as one of the spells which worked in his youth and was entirely ineffective by the time he was 20.
Your superior skill, began Lascelles.
My superior skill has nothing to do with it, snapped Mr. Norrell. I cannot do magic that is not there. Magic is returning to England. Strange has found a way to bring it back.
Then I was right, was I not? Said Lascelles. And our first task is to prevent him returning to England. Succeed in that, and Lord Liverpool will forgive a great many other things.
Mr. Norrell thought for a moment.
I can prevent him arriving by sea, he said.
Excellent, said Lascelles.
Then something in the way Mr. Norrell had phrased this last statement gave him pause.
Well, he is scarcely likely to come any other way. He cannot fly.
He gave a light laugh at the idea. Then another thought struck him.
Can he?
Childermas shrugged.
I do not know what Strange might be capable of by now, said Mr. Norrell. But I was not thinking of that. I was thinking of the King's Roads.
Well, I thought the King's Roads led to Faerie, said Lascelles.
Yes, they do, but not only Faerie. The King's Roads lead everywhere, heaven, hell, the Houses of Parliament. They were built by magic. Every mirror, every puddle, every shadow in England is a gate to those roads. I cannot set a lock upon all of them. Nobody could. It will be a monstrous task. If Strange comes by the King's Roads, then I know nothing to prevent him.
But, began Lascelles,
I cannot prevent him, cried Mr. Norrell, wringing his hands. Do not ask me. But
he made a great effort to calm himself.
I can be ready to receive him, the greatest magician of the age. Well, soon we shall see, shall we not?
If he comes to England, said Lascelles, where will he go first?
Hertfew Abbey, said Childermas. Where else?
Mr. Norrell and Lascelles were both about to answer him, but at that moment Lucas entered the room with a silver tray, upon which lay a letter. He offered it to Lascelles. Lascelles broke the seal and read it rapidly.
Drawlight is back, he said. Wait for me here. I will return within a day.
Chapter 62. I came to them in a cry that broke the silence of a winter wood. Early February, 1817. First light in early February, a crossroads in the middle of a wood. The space between the trees was misty and indistinct. The darkness of the trees seeped into it. Neither of the two roads was of any importance. They were rutted and ill-maintained. One was scarcely more than a cart track. It was an out-of-the-way place marked on no map. It did not even have a name. Drawlight was waiting at the crossroads. There was no horse standing nearby, no groom with a trap or cart, nothing to explain how he had come there. Yet clearly he had been standing at the crossroads for some time. His coat sleeves were white with frost. A faint click behind him made him spin round. But there was nothing, only the same stretch of silent trees.
No, he muttered to himself. It was nothing. A dry leaf fell, that's all.
There was a sharp snap as ice cracked wood or stone. He stared again, with eyes addled by fear.
It was only a dry leaf, he murmured.
There was a new sound. For a moment he was all in a panic, uncertain where it was coming from, until he recognized it for what it was. Horses' hooves. He peered up the road. A dim grey smudge in the mist showed where a horse and rider were approaching.
He is here at last. He is here, muttered Drawlight, and hastened forward.
Where have you been? He cried. I've been waiting here for hours.
So, said Lascelles' voice,
you have nothing else to do.
Oh, but you're wrong. You could not be more wrong. You must take me to London as quickly as possible, all in good time.
Lascelles emerged from the mist and reined in his horse. His fine clothes and hat were beaded with a silvery dusting of dew. Drawlight regarded him for a moment, and then, with something of his old character, said sulkily,
How nicely you are dressed. But really, you know, it's not very clever of you to parade your wealth like that. Are you not afraid of robbers? This is a very horrid spot. I dare say there are all sorts of desperate characters close at hand.
You are probably right. But you see, I have my pistols with me, and am quite as desperate as any of them.
Drawlight was struck by a sudden thought.
Where is the other horse? He asked.
What?
Well, the other horse. The one that is to take me to London. Oh, Lascelles, you noodlehead. How am I to get to London without a horse?
Lascelles laughed.
I would have thought you would have been glad to avoid it. Your debts may have been paid off. I have paid them. But London is still full of people who hate you and will do you an ill turn if they can.
Drawlight stared as if he had understood none of this.
In a shrill, excited voice he cried, But I have instructions from the magician. He has given me messages to deliver to all sorts of people. I must begin immediately. I must not delay a single hour.
Lascelles frowned.
Are you drunk? Are you dreaming? Norrell's not asked you to do anything. If he had tasks for you, he would convey them through me, and besides, not Norrell.
Strange.
Lascelles sat stock still upon his horse. The horse shifted and fidgeted, but Lascelles moved not at all. Then, in a softer, more dangerous voice, he said,
What in the world are you talking about? Strange? How dare you talk to me of strange? I advise you to think very carefully before you speak again. I am already seriously displeased. Your instructions were quite plain, I think. You were to remain at Venice until Strange left. But here you are, and there he is.
I could not help it. I had to leave.
You do not understand.
I saw him, and he told me— Lascelles held up his hand. I have no wish to conduct this conversation in the open.
We will go a little way into the trees.
Into the trees?
The little colour that was left in Drawlight's face drained away.
Oh, no, not for the world. I will not go there. Do not ask me.
What do you mean?
Lascelles looked round, a little less comfortable than before.
Has Strange set the trees to spy on us?
No, no, that's not it. I cannot explain it.
They're waiting for me. They know me. I cannot go in there.
Drawlight had no words for what had happened to him. He held out his arms for a moment, as if he thought he could show Lascelles the rivers that had curled about his feet, the trees that had pierced him, the stones that had been his heart and lungs and guts. Lascelles raised his riding whip.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
He urged his horse at Drawlight and flourished the whip. Poor Drawlight had never possessed the least physical courage, and he was driven whimpering into the trees. A briar caught the edge of his sleeve, and he screamed.
Oh, do be quiet, said Lascelles. Anyone would think there is murder going on.
They walked on until they came to a small clearing. Lascelles got down from his horse and tethered him to a tree. He removed the two pistols from the saddle holsters and stuck them in the pockets of his greatcoat. Then he turned to Drawlight.
So, you actually saw Strange?
Good.
Excellent, in fact.
I was sure you were too cowardly to face him.
I thought he would change me into something horrible.
Lascelles surveyed Drawlight's stained clothing and haunted face with some distaste.
Are you sure he did not do it?
What? Said Drawlight.
Why did you not simply kill him, there in the darkness?
You were alone, I presume. No one would have known.
Oh, yes, that is very likely, is it not? He is tall and clever and quick and cruel. I am none of those things.
I would have done it, said Lascelles.
Would you? Well, then, you are very welcome to go to Venice and try.
Where is he now?
In the darkness, in Venice.
But he's coming to England.
You said so?
Yes, I told you. I have messages, one for Childermas, one for Norrell, and one for all the magicians in England.
And what are they?
I am to tell Childermas that Lady Pole was not raised from the dead in the way Norrell said. He had a fairy to help him, and the fairy has done things, wrong things, and I am to give Childermas a little box. That is the first message. And I am to tell Norrell that Strange is coming back. That is the third message.
Lascelles considered.
This little box, what does it contain?
I do not know.
Why, is it sealed shut in some way by magic?
Drawlight shut his eyes and shook his head.
I do not know that either.
Lascelles laughed out loud.
You do not mean to tell me that you have had a box in your possession for weeks and not tried to open it. You, of all people.
Why, when you used to come to my house, I never dared leave you alone for a moment. My letters would have been read, my business would have been common knowledge by the next morning.
Drawlight's glance sank to the ground. He seemed to shrink inside his clothes. He grew, if it were possible, several degrees more miserable. One might have supposed that he was ashamed to hear his past sins described, but it was not that.
I am afraid, he whispered.
Lascelles made a sound of exasperation.
Where is the box? He cried.
Give it to me.
Drawlight reached into a pocket of his coat and brought out something wrapped in a dirty handkerchief. The handkerchief was tied into many wonderfully complicated knots, to guard against the box coming open of its own accord. Drawlight gave it to Lascelles. With a series of grimaces, expressive of extreme distaste, Lascelles set himself to undo the knots. When he had done so, he opened the box. A moment's silence.
"You're a fool," said Lascelles, and shut the box with a snap, and put it in his own pocket.
"Oh, but I have to,"
began Drawlight, reaching out ineffectually.
"You said there were three messages. What is the other one?"
"I do not think you will understand it."
"What? You understand it, yet I will not. You must have grown a great deal cleverer in Italy."
"That's not what I meant."
"Then what do you mean? Tell me quickly, I'm growing bored of this conversation."
"Strange said that the trees speak to stone. A stone speaks to water. He said magicians can learn magic from woods and stones and such. He said Jan Usglas's old alliances still held."
Jan Usglas, how sick I am of that name. Yet they all rattle on about him nowadays. Even Norrell. I cannot understand why. His day was done 400 years ago.
Drawlight held out his hand again.
"Give me back my box. I must..." "What the devil is the matter with you?
Do you not understand? Your messages will never be delivered, except for the one to Norrell, and that I shall deliver myself."
A howl of anguish burst from Drawlight.
"Please, please do not make me fail him. You do not understand. He will kill me, or worse."
Lascelles spread his arms and glanced around, as if asking the wood to bear witness how ridiculous this was. "Do you honestly believe that I would allow you to destroy Norrell? Which is to say, destroy me?"
"It's not my fault. It's not my fault. I dare not disobey him."
"Well, what will you do between two such men as Strange and I? You will be crushed."
Drawlight made a little sound like a whimper of fear. He gazed at Lascelles with strange, addled eyes. He seemed about to say something. Then, with surprising speed, he turned and fled through the trees. Lascelles did not trouble to follow him. He simply raised one of the pistols, aimed it, and fired. The bullet struck Drawlight in the thigh, producing for one instant a red, wet flowering of blood and flesh in the white and grey woods. Drawlight screamed and fell with a crash into a patch of briars. He tried to crawl away, but his leg was quite useless, and besides, the briars were catching at his clothes. He could not pull free of them. He turned his head to see Lascelles advance upon him. Fear and pain rendered his features entirely unrecognizable. Lascelles fired the second pistol. The left side of Drawlight's head burst open like an egg or an orange. He convulsed several times and was still. Although there was no one there to see, and although his blood was pounding in his ears and in his chest, in his everything, Lascelles would not permit himself to appear in the least disturbed. That, he felt, would not have been the behaviour of a gentleman. He had a valet who was much addicted to accounts of murders and hangings in the Newgate Calendar or the Malefactor's Register. Sometimes Lascelles would amuse himself by picking up one of these volumes. A prominent characteristic of these histories was that the murderer, however bold he was during the act of murder, would soon afterwards be overcome with emotion, leading him to act in strange, irrational ways that were always his undoing. Lascelles doubted there was much truth in these accounts, but for safety's sake he examined himself for signs of remorse or horror. He found none. Indeed, his chief thought was that there was one less ugly thing in the world. Really, he said to himself, if he had known 3 or 4 years ago that it would come to this, he would have begged me to do it. There was a rustling sound. To Lascelles' surprise, he saw that a small shoot was poking out of Drawlight's right eye. The left one had been destroyed by the pistol blast. Strands of ivy were winding themselves about his neck and chest. A holly shoot had pierced his hand. A young birch had shot up through his foot. A hawthorn had sprung up through his belly. He looked as if he'd been crucified upon the wood itself. But the trees did not stop there. They kept growing. A tangle of bronze and scarlet stems blotted out his ruined face, and his limbs and body decayed as plants and other living things took strength from them. Within a short space of time, nothing of Christopher Drawlight remained. The trees, the stones, and the earth had taken him inside themselves. But in their shape, it was possible still to discern something of the man he had once been. "That briar was his arm, I think," mused Lascelles. "That stone, his heart, perhaps? It is small enough and hard enough. He laughed. That is the ridiculous thing about strangers' magic, he said to no one at all. Sooner or later it all works against him. He mounted on his horse and rode back towards the road.
Chapter 63. The first shall bury his heart in a dark wood beneath the snow, yet still feel its ache. Mid-February, 1817. More than 28 hours had passed since Lascelles had left Hanover Square, and Mr. Norrell was half frantic. He had promised Lascelles they would wait for him, but now he feared they would arrive at Hurtview Abbey to find Strange in possession of the library. No one in the house at Hanover Square was permitted to go to bed that night, and by morning everyone was tired and wretched. "But why do we wait at all?" asked Childermas. "What good do you suppose he will be when Strange comes?"
"I've placed great reliance on Mr. Lascelles. You know I do. He is my only adviser now."
"You still have me," said Childermas.
Mr. Norrell blinked his small eyes rapidly. They seemed to be half a sentence away from,
"But you are only a servant."
Mr. Norrell said nothing. Childermas seemed to understand him anyway. He made a small sound of disgust and walked off. At 6 o'clock in the evening, the library door was thrown open, and Lascelles walked in. He looked as he had never looked before. His hair was disheveled, his neckcloth was stained with dust and sweat, and there were mud splashes on his greatcoat and boots.
"We were right, Mr. Norrell," he cried. "Strange is coming."
"When?" said Mr. Norrell, turning pale.
"I do not know. He has not been so kind as to furnish us with those details, but we should leave for Hurtview Abbey as soon as possible."
"We can go immediately. All is in readiness. So, you actually saw Drawlight. Is he here?"
Mr. Norrell leant sideways to see if he could catch a glimpse of Drawlight behind Lascelles.
No, I did not see him. I waited for him, but he never came. But do not fear, sir."
Mr. Norrell was on the point of interrupting.
"He has sent a letter. We have all the intelligence we need."
"A letter? May I see it?"
"Of course. But there will be time enough for that on the journey. We must be off. You need not delay on my account. My wants are few, and what I do not have, I can very easily do without."
This was perhaps a little surprising. Lascelles' wants had never been few before. They had been numerous and complicated.
"Come, come, Mr. Norrell, rouse yourself. Strange is coming."
He strode out of the room again. Mr. Norrell heard later from Lucas that he had not even asked for water to wash or for anything to drink. He had simply gone to the carriage, thrown himself into a corner, and waited. By 8 o'clock, they were on their way to Yorkshire. Mr. Norrell and Lascelles were inside the carriage. Lucas and Davy were upon the box. Childermas was on horseback. At the Islington tollgate, Lucas paid the keeper. There was a smell of snow in the air. Mr. Norrell gazed idly at a shop window ablaze with lamplight. It was a superior sort of shop, with an uncluttered interior and elegant modern chairs for the customers to sit upon. In fact, it was so very refined an establishment that it was by no means clear what it sold. A heap of brightly coloured somethings lay tossed upon a chair, but whether they were shawls or materials for gowns or something else entirely, Mr. Norrell could not tell. There were three women in the shop. One was a customer, a smart, stylish person in a spencer like a hussar's uniform, complete with fur trim and frogging. On her head was a little Russian fur cap. She kept touching the back of it, as if she feared it would fall off. The shopkeeper was more discreetly dressed, in a plain dark gown, and there was, besides, a little assistant, who looked on respectfully and bobbed a nervous little curtsy whenever anyone chanced to look at her. The customer and the shopkeeper were not engaged in business. They were talking together with a great deal of animation and laughter. It was a scene as far removed from Mr. Norrell's usual interests as it was possible to be, yet it went to his heart in a way he could not understand. He thought fleetingly of Mrs. Strange and Lady Pole. Then something flew between him and the cheerful scene, something like a piece of darkness made solid. He thought that it was a raven. The toll was paid, Davy shook the reins, and the carriage moved on towards the archway. Snow began to fall. The sleety wind buffeted the sides of the carriage and made it rock from side to side. It penetrated every chink and crack and chilled shoulders, noses, and feet. Mr. Norrell was not made any more comfortable by the fact that Lascelles appeared to be in a very odd mood. He was excited, almost elated, though Mr. Norrell could not tell why he should be. When the wind howled, he laughed, as if he suspected it of trying to frighten him, and wished to show it that it was mistaken. When he saw that Mr. Norrell was observing him, he said,
"I've been thinking. This is the merest nothing. You and I, sir, will soon get the better of Strange and his tricks. What a pack of old women the ministers are. They disgust me. All this alarm over one lunatic. It makes me laugh to think of it. Of course, Liverpool and Sidmouth are the worst of them. For years they have hardly dared put their noses out of their front doors for fear of Bonaparte, and now Strange has sent them into fits merely by going insane."
"Oh, but you are wrong," declared Mr. Norrell. "Indeed you are. The threat from Strange is immense. Bonaparte was nothing to it. But you have not told me what Drawlight said. I should very much like to see his letter. I'll tell Davy to stop at the Angel in Hadley, and then—"
"But I do not have it. I left it at Bruton Street."
"Oh, but—" Lascelles laughed.
"Mr. Norrell, do not concern yourself. Do I not tell you that it does not matter? I recall it exactly."
"What does it say?"
"That Strange is mad and imprisoned in eternal darkness, all of which we knew before, and—"
"What form does his madness take?" asked Mr. Norrell.
The merest pause.
"Talking nonsense, mostly. But then he did that before, did he not?"
Lascelles laughed. Catching sight of Mr. Norrell's expression, he continued more soberly.
"He babbles about trees and stones and John Usklas and—" glancing round for inspiration— "invisible coaches. And, oh yes, this will amuse you. He has stolen fingers off the hands of several Venetian maidens. Stolen them clean away. Keeps the stolen fingers in little boxes."
"Fingers?"
said Mr. Norrell in alarm. This seemed to suggest some unpleasant association to him. He thought for a moment, but could make nothing of it.
"Did Drawlight describe the darkness? Did he say anything that might help us understand it?"
"No. He saw Strange, and Strange gave him a message for you. He says that he is coming. That is the substance of the letter."
They fell into silence. Mr. Norrell began to doze without intending to. Several times in his dreams he heard Lascelles whispering to himself in the darkness. At midnight they changed horses at the Haycock Inn at Wansford. Lascelles and Mr. Norrell waited in the public parlour, a large plain apartment with wood-panelled walls, a sanded floor, and two great fireplaces. The door opened, and Childermas walked in. He went straight to Lascelles and addressed him in the following words.
"Lucas says there is a letter from Drawlight telling what he has seen in Venice."
Lascelles half turned his head, but he did not look at Childermas.
"May I see it?"
asked Childermas.
"I left it at Bruton Street,"
said Lascelles.
Childermas looked a little surprised. "Very well, then," he said. "Lucas can fetch it. We'll hire a horse for him here. He'll catch up with us again before we reach Hertview."
Lascelles smiled.
"I said Bruton Street, did I not? But you know, I do not think it is there. I believe I left it at an inn, the one in Chatham, where I waited for Drawlight. They will have thrown it away."
He turned back to the fire. Childermas scowled at him for a moment or two. Then he strode out of the room. A manservant came to say that hot water, towels, and other necessaries had been set out in two bedchambers, so that Mr. Norrell and Lascelles might refresh themselves.
"And it's a blind man's holiday in the passageway, gentlemen," he said cheerfully, "so I've lit you a candle each."
Mr. Norrell took his candle and made his way along the passageway, which was indeed very dark. Suddenly, Childermas appeared and seized his arm.
"What in the world were you thinking of?" he hissed. "To leave London without that ladder."
"But he says he remembers what it contains,"
pleaded Mr. Norrell.
"Ah, and you believe him, do you?"
Mr. Norrell made no reply. He went into the room that had been made ready. He washed his hands and face, and as he did so, he caught a glimpse in the mirror of the bed behind him. It was heavy, old-fashioned, and as often happens at inns, much too large for the room. Four carved mahogany columns, a high dark canopy, and bunches of black ostrich feathers at each corner all contrived to give it a funereal look. It was as if someone had brought him into the room and shown him his own tomb. He began to have the strangest feeling. The same feeling he had had at the toll gate, watching the three women. The feeling that something was coming to an end, and that all his choices had now been made. He had taken a road in his youth, but the road did not lead where he had supposed. He was going home, but home had become something monstrous. In the half-dark, standing by the black bed, he remembered why he had always feared the darkness as a child. The darkness belonged to John Usklas. For always and for always, I pray remember me, upon the moors beneath the stars, with the king's wild company. He hurried from the room, back to the warmth and lights of the public parlour. A little after 6 o'clock, a grey dawn came up that was scarcely any dawn at all. White snow fell through a grey sky onto a grey and white world. Davy was so liberally coated in snow that one might have supposed that someone had ordered a waxworks model of him, and the plaster mould was being prepared. All that day, a succession of post-horses laboured to bring the carriage through snow and wind. A succession of inns provided hot drinks and a brief respite from the weather. Davy and Childermas, who as coachman and rider were undoubtedly the most exhausted of the party, derived the least benefit from these halts. They were generally in the stables, arguing with the innkeeper about the horses. At Grantham, the innkeeper infuriated Childermas by proposing to rent them a stone-blind horse. Childermas swore he would not take it. The innkeeper, on the other hand, swore it was the best horse he had. There was very little choice, and they ended by hiring it. Davy said afterwards that it was an excellent beast, hard-working and all the more obedient to his instructions, since it had no other means of knowing where to go or what to do. Davy himself lasted as far as the Newcastle Arms at Tuxford, and there they were obliged to leave him. He had driven more than 130 miles, and was, said Childermas, so tired he could barely speak. Childermas hired a postillion, and they travelled on. An hour or so before sunset, the snow ceased and the skies cleared. Long, blue-black shadows overlaid the bare fields. 5 miles out of Doncaster, they passed the inn that is called the Red House, by reason of its painted walls. In the low winter sun, it blazed like a house of fire. The carriage went on a little way, and then halted.
"Why are we stopping?" cried Mr. Norrell from within.
Lucas leant down from the box and said something in reply, but the wind carried his voice away, and Mr. Norrell did not hear what it was. Childermas had left the highway and was riding across a field. The field was filled with ravens. As he passed, they flew up with a great croaking and cawing. On the far side of the field was an ancient hedge with an opening and two tall holly trees, one on each side. The opening led into another road or lane bounded by hedges. Childermas halted there and looked first one way and then the other. He hesitated, then he shook his reins, and the horse trotted between the trees into the lane and out of sight.
"He's gone into a fairy road," cried Mr. Norrell in alarm.
"Oh," said Lascelles, "is that what it is?"
"Yes, indeed," said Mr. Norrell. "That is one of the more famous ones. It is reputed to have joined Doncaster to Newcastle by way of two fairy citadels."
They waited. After about 20 minutes, Lucas climbed down from the box.
"How long ought we to stay here, sir?" he asked.
Mr. Norrell shook his head.
"No Englishman has stepped over the boundaries into Fairy since Martin Pale 300 years ago. It is perfectly possible that he will never come out again. Perhaps—"
Just then Childermas reappeared and galloped back across the field.
"Well, it is true," he told Mr. Norrell. "The paths to Fairy are open again."
"What did you see?" asked Mr. Norrell.
"The road goes on a little way, and then leads into a wood of thorn trees. At the entrance to the wood, there's a statue of a woman with her hands outstretched. In one hand she holds a stone eye, and in the other, a stone heart. As for the wood itself—"
Childermas made a gesture, perhaps expressive of his inability to describe what he'd seen, or perhaps of his powerlessness in the face of it.
"Corpses hang from every tree. Some might have died as recently as yesterday. Others are no more than age-old skeletons dressed in rusting armour. I came to a high tower built of rough-hewn stones. The walls were pierced with a few tiny windows. There was a light at one of them, and a shadow of someone looking out. Beneath the tower was a clearing with a brook running through it. A young man was standing there. He looked pale and sickly, with dead eyes, and he wore a British uniform. He told me he was the champion of the castle, of the plucked eye and heart. He had sworn to protect the lady of the castle by challenging anyone who approached with the intent of harming or insulting her. I asked him if he had killed all the men I'd seen. He said he killed some of them and hung them upon the thorns, as his predecessor had done before him. I asked him how the lady intended to reward him for his service. He said he did not know. He had never seen her or spoken to her. She remained in the castle of the plucked eye and heart. He stayed between the brook and the thorn trees. He asked me if I intended to fight him. I reminded him that I'd neither insulted nor harmed his lady. I told him I was a servant, and bound to return to my master, who was at that moment waiting for me. Then I turned my horse and rode back. "What?" cried Lascelles. "A man offers to fight you and you run away? Have you no honor at all, no shame? A sickly face, dead eyes, an unknown person at the window?" He gave a snort of derision. "These are nothing but excuses for your cowardice." Childemas flinched, as if he'd been struck, and seemed about to return a sharp answer, but he was interrupted by Mr. Norrell.
"Upon the contrary, Childemas did well to leave as soon as he could. There is always more magic in such a place than appears at first sight. Some fairies delight in combat and death. I do not know why. They are prepared to go to great lengths to secure such pleasures for themselves."
"Please, Mr. Lascelles," said Childemas, "if the place has a strong appeal for you, then go. Do not stay upon our account."
Lascelles looked thoughtfully at the field and the gap in the hedge, but he did not move.
"You do not like the ravens, perhaps," said Childemas, in a quietly mocking tone.
"No one likes them," declared Mr. Norrell. "Why are they here? What do they mean?"
Childemas shrugged.
"Some people think that they're part of the darkness that envelops Strange, and which, for some reason, he is made incarnate and sent back to England. Other people think that they portend the return of John Usglas."
"John Usglas, of course," said Lascelles.
"The first and last resort of vulgar minds. Whenever anything happens, it must be because of John Usglas. I think, Mr. Norrell, it is time for another article in the Friends reviling that gentleman. What shall we say? That he was unchristian, un-English, demonic? Somewhere I believe I have a list of the saints and archbishops who denounced him. I could easily work that up."
Mr. Norrell looked uncomfortable. He glanced nervously at the Tuxford postillion.
"If I were you, Mr. Lascelles," said Childemas softly, "I would speak more guardedly. You're in the north now, in John Usglas's own country. Our towns and cities and abbeys were built by him. Our laws were made by him. He is in our minds and hearts and speech. Were it summer, you would see a carpet of tiny flowers beneath every hedgerow of a bluish-white colour. We call them John's farthings. When the weather is contrary and we have warm weather in winter or it rains in summer, the country people say that John Usglas is in love again and neglects his business."
Footnote 1. It has often been observed that the northern English, though never wavering in their loyalty to John Usglas, do not always treat him with the respect he commands in the south. In fact, Usglas's subjects take a particular delight in stories and ballads that show him at a decided disadvantage. For example, the tale of John Usglas and the charcoal burner of Ulswater, or the tale of the hag and the sorceress. There are many versions of the latter, some of them quite vulgar. It tells how Usglas almost lost his heart, his kingdoms, and his power to a common Cornish witch. And when we're sure of something, we say it is as safe as a pebble in John Usglas's pocket. Lascelles laughed.
"Far be it from me, Mr. Childemas, to disparage your quaint country sayings. But surely it is one thing to pay lip service to one's history, and quite another to talk of bringing back a king who numbered Lucifer himself among his allies and overlords. No one wants that, do they? I mean, apart from a few Yeomanites and madmen."
"I'm a North Englishman, Mr. Lascelles," said Childemas. "Nothing would please me better than that my king should come home. That is what I have wished for all my life."
It was nearly midnight when they arrived at Hertview Abbey. There was no sign of Strange. Lascelles went to bed, but Mr. Norrell walked about the house, examining the condition of certain spells that had long been in place. Next morning, at breakfast, Lascelles said, "I've been wondering if there were ever magical duels in the past, struggles between two magicians, that sort of thing." Mr. Norrell sighed. "It is difficult to know. Ralph Stokesy seems to have fought two or three magicians by magic. One, a very powerful Scottish magician, the magician of Atherdell." Footnote 2. Like John Usglask, the magician of Atherdell ruled his own island or kingdom. Atherdell seems to have been one of the Western Isles of Scotland, but either it has sunk or else it is, as some people think, invisible. Some Scottish historians like to see Atherdell as evidence of the superiority of Scottish magic over English. John Usglas's kingdom, they argue, has fallen and is in the hands of the southern English, whereas Atherdell remains independent. Since Atherdell is both invisible and inaccessible, this is a difficult proposition to prove or disprove.
Catherine of Winchester was once driven to send a young magician to Granada by magic. He kept disturbing her with inconvenient proposals of marriage when she wanted to study, and Granada was the furthest place she could think of at the time. Then there is the curious tale of the Cumbrian charcoal burner.
Footnote 3. In the tale of John Usglas and the charcoal burner of Ulswater, Usglas engages in a contest of magic with a poor charcoal burner and loses. It bears similarities to other old stories in which a great ruler is outwitted by one of his humblest subjects, and because of this, many scholars have argued that it has no historical basis.
And did such duels ever end in the death of one of the magicians?
What?
Mr. Norrell stared at him horror-struck.
No. Well, that is to say, I do not know. I do not think so.
Lascelles smiled.
Yet the magic must exist, surely.
If you gave your mind to it, I dare say you could think of half a dozen spells that would do the trick. It would be like a common duel with pistols or swords. There would be no question of a prosecution afterwards. Besides, the victor's friends and servants would be perfectly justified in helping him shroud the matter in all possible secrecy. Mr. Norrell was silent. Then he said,
"It will not come to that."
Lascelles laughed.
"My dear Mr. Norrell, what else could it possibly come to?"
Curiously, Lascelles had never been to Hertfew Abbey before. Whenever, in days gone by, Drawlight had gone to stay there, Lascelles had always contrived to have a previous engagement. A sojourn at a country house in Yorkshire was Lascelles' idea of purgatory. At best, he fancied Hertfew must be like its owner, dusty, old-fashioned, and given to long, dull silences. At worst, he pictured a rain-lashed farmhouse upon a dark, dreary moor. He was surprised to find that it was none of these things. There was nothing of the Gothic about it. The house was modern, elegant, and comfortable, and the servants were far from the uncouth farmhands of his imagination. In fact, they were the same servants who waited upon Mr. Norrell in Hanover Square. They were London-trained and well acquainted with all Lascelles' preferences. But any magician's house has its oddities. And Hertfew Abbey, at first sight so commodious and elegant, seemed to have been constructed upon a plan so extremely muddled-headed that it was quite impossible to go from one side of the house to the other without getting lost. Later that morning, Lascelles was informed by Lucas that he must on no account attempt to go to the library alone, but only in the company of Mr. Norrell or Childermas. It was, said Lucas, the first rule of the house. Naturally, Lascelles had no intention of obeying such a prohibition delivered to him by a servant. He examined the eastern part of the house and found the usual arrangement of morning room, dining room, drawing room, but no library. He concluded that the library must lie in the unexplored western part. He set off and immediately found himself back in the room he'd just left. Thinking he must have taken a wrong turn, he tried again. This time, he arrived at one of the sculleries, where a small, unclean, sniffling maid first wiped her nose on the back of her hand and then used that same hand to wash the cooking pots. No matter which path he chose, it returned him immediately to either morning room or the scullery. He grew very sick of the sight of the little maid, and she didn't seem exactly overjoyed to see him. But though he wasted an entire morning on this fruitless endeavor, it never occurred to him to attribute his failure to to anything other than a peculiarity of Yorkshire architecture. For the next 3 days, Mr. Norrell kept to the library as much as he could. Whenever he saw Lascelles, he was sure to hear some fresh complaint about Childermas, while Childermas kept harassing him with demands that he search for Drawlight's letter by magic. In the end, he found it easier to avoid them both. Nor did he divulge to either of them something he had discovered, which worried him a great deal. Ever since he and Strange had parted, he'd been in the habit of summoning up visions to try and discover what Strange was doing, but he'd never succeeded. One night, about 4 weeks ago, he'd not been able to sleep. He had got up and performed the magic. The vision had not been very distinct, but he had seen a magician in the darkness doing magic. He had congratulated himself on penetrating Strange's counterspells at last, until it occurred to him that he was looking at a vision of himself in his own library. He tried again. He had varied the spells. He named Strange in different ways. It did not matter. He was forced to conclude that English magic could no longer tell the difference between himself and Strange. Letters arrived from Lord Liverpool and the ministers with angry descriptions of more magic which no one could explain. Mr. Norrell wrote back, promising his earliest attention to these matters just as soon as Strange had been defeated. On the third evening after their arrival, Mr. Norrell, Lascelles, and Childermas were gathered together in the drawing-room. Lascelles was eating an orange. He had a little pearl-handled fruit knife with a jagged blade, which he used to cut the peel. Childermas was laying out his cards upon a little table. He'd been reading the cards for the past 2 hours. There was a measure of how far Mr. Norrell was distracted by the present situation that he made not the slightest objection. Lascelles, on the other hand, was driven half mad by those cards. He was certain that one of the subjects of all those layings out and turnings over was himself. In this, he was perfectly correct.
"How I detest this inactivity," he said abruptly. "What can Strange be waiting for, do you suppose? We do not even know for certain that he will come."
"He will come," said Childermas.
"And how do you know that?" asked Lascelles. "Because you've told him to?"
Childermas did not respond. Something he'd seen in the cards had claimed his attention. His glance flickered over them. Suddenly, he rose from the table.
"Mr. Lascelles, you have a message for me."
"I?" said Lascelles in surprise.
"Yes, sir."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that someone has recently given you a message for me. The cards say so. I would be grateful if you would deliver it to me."
Lascelles gave a snort of contempt.
"I'm not anybody's messenger. Yours, least of all."
Childermas ignored this.
"Who is the message from?" he asked.
Lascelles said nothing. He went back to his knife and his orange.
"Very well," said Childermas,
and he sat down and laid out the cards again. Mr. Norrell, in a state of great apprehension, watched them. His hand fluttered up towards the bell cord, but after a moment's consideration, he changed his mind and went in search of a servant himself. Lucas was in the dining room laying the table. Mr. Norrell told him what was going on.
"Cannot something be done to separate them?" he asked. "They might be cooler in a while. He has no message come for Mr. Lascelles. Is there nothing that needs Childermas's attention? Can you not invent something? What about dinner? Can it be ready?"
Lucas shook his head.
"There is no message. Mr. Childermas will do as he pleases. He always does. And you ordered dinner for 9:30, sir. You know you did."
"I wish Mr. Strange were here," said Mr. Norrell miserably.
"He would know what to say to them. He would know what to do."
Lucas touched his master's arm, as if trying to rouse him.
"Mr. Norrell, we're trying to prevent Mr. Strange from coming here, if you remember, sir."
Mr. Norrell looked at him in some irritation.
"Yes, yes, I know that. But still..."
Mr. Norrell and Lucas returned to the drawing room together. Childermas was turning over his last card. Lascelles was staring with great determination at a newspaper.
"What do the cards say?"
said Mr. Norrell to Childermas. Mr. Norrell asked the question, but Childermas spoke his answer to Lascelles.
"They say that you're a liar and a thief. They say there is more than a message. You've been given something, an object, something of great value. It is meant for me, and yet you retain it."
A short silence. Lascelles said coldly, "Mr. Norrell, how long do you intend that I shall be insulted in this manner?"
"I ask you for the last time, Mr. Lascelles," said Childermas. "Will you give me what is mine?"
"How dare you address a gentleman in such a fashion?" asked Lascelles.
"And is it the act of a gentleman to steal from me?" replied Childermas.
Lascelles turned a dead white.
"Apologize," he hissed. "Apologize to me, or I swear, you whoreson, you dregs of every Yorkshire gutter, I will teach you better manners."
Childermas shrugged.
"Better a whoreson than a thief."
With a cry of rage, Lascelles seized him and thrust him against the wall so hard that Childermas's feet actually left the ground. He shook Childermas, and the paintings on the wall rattled in their frames. Curiously, Childermas seemed defenseless against Lascelles. His arms had somehow got pinned against Lascelles' body, and though he struggled hard, he seemed unable to free them. It was over in a moment. Childermas nodded briefly at Lascelles, as if to say Lascelles had won. But Lascelles did not release him. Instead, he leant hard against him, keeping him trapped against the wall. Then he reached down and picked up the pearl-handled knife with the jagged edge. He drew the blade slowly across Childermas's face, cutting him from eye to mouth. Lucas let out a cry, but Childermas said nothing at all. He somehow freed his left hand and raised it. It was closed in a tight fist. They remained like that for a moment, a tableau. Then Childermas dropped his hand. Lascelles smiled broadly. He let Childermas go and turned to Mr. Norrell. In a calm, quiet voice, he addressed him thus. "I will not suffer any excuses to be made for this person. I have been insulted. If this person were of a rank to be noticed by me, I should certainly call him out. He knows it. His inferior condition protects him. If I am to remain another moment in this house, if I am to continue as your friend and adviser, then this person must leave your service this minute. After tonight, I can never hear his name spoken by you or any of your servants again, on pain of dismissal. I hope, sir, that this is sufficiently plain."
Lucas took the opportunity to hand Childermas a surreptitious napkin.
"Well, sir," said Childermas to Mr. Norrell, wiping the blood from his face, "which of us is it to be?"
A long moment of silence. Then, in a hoarse voice, quite unlike his usual tone, Mr. Norrell said,
"You must go."
"Goodbye, Mr. Norrell," said Childermas, bowing.
"You've made the wrong choice, sir. As usual."
He gathered up his cards and left. He went up to his bare little attic bedroom and lit the candle which stood upon a table. There was a cracked, cheap-looking glass hanging on the wall. He examined his face. The cut was ugly. His neckcloth and the right shoulder of his shirt were soaked in blood. He washed the wound as best he could. Then he washed and dried his hands. Carefully, he took something out of his coat pocket. It was a box, the color of heartache, about the size of a snuff box, but a little longer. He whispered to himself,
"A man cannot help his training."
Footnote 4. At the engraver's house in Spitalfields in the early spring of 1816, Strange had told Childermas, "One can never help one's training, you know." Childermas had had several careers before he became Mr. Norrell's servant and adviser. His first was as a highly talented child pickpocket. His mother, Black Joan, had once managed a small pack of dirty, ragged child thieves that had worked the towns of the East Riding in the late 1770s. He opened it. For a moment or two, he looked thoughtful. He scratched his head and then cursed because he had very nearly dropped blood into it. He snapped it shut and put it in his pocket. It did not take long to collect his possessions. There was a mahogany case containing a pair of pistols, a small purse of money, a razor, a comb, a toothbrush, a bit of soap, some clothes, all as ancient as the ones he was wearing, and a small parcel of books, including a Bible, a Child's History of the Raven King by Lord Portishead, and a copy of Paris Ormskirk's Revelations of 36 Other Worlds. Mr. Norrell had paid Childermas well for years, but what he did with his money, no one knew. As Davy and Lucas had often remarked to each other, he certainly didn't spend it. Childermas packed everything into a battered valise. There was a dish of apples upon the table. He wrapped them in a cloth and added them to the valise. Then, holding the napkin to his face, he went downstairs. He was in the stable yard before he remembered that his pen, ink, and memorandum book were still in the drawing room. He had put them on a side table while he read his cards.
Well, it's too late to go back, he thought. I shall have to buy others.
There was a party waiting for him in the stables. Davy, Lucas, the grooms, and several of the manservants who had managed to slip away from the house.
What are all you doing here?
He asked in surprise.
Holding a prayer meeting?
The men glanced at each other.
We saddled Brewer for you, Mr. Childermas, said Davy.
Brewer was Childermas's horse, a big, unhandsome stallion.
Thank you, Davy. Why did you let him do it, sir?
Asked Lucas.
Why did you let him cut you?
Don't fret about it, lad. It's of no consequence.
I brought bandages. Let me bind up your face.
Lucas, I need my wits tonight. I cannot think if I'm all over bandages.
But it will leave a terrible scar if the lips of the wound are not closed.
Let it. No one will complain if I'm less beautiful than I was. Just give me another clout to staunch the flow.
Footnote 5. A Yorkshire word meaning cloth.
This one is soaked through. Now, lads, when Strange comes, he sighed, I don't know what to tell you. I have no advice. But if you get a chance to help them, then do it.
What?
Asked one manservant.
Help Mr. Norrell and Mr. Lascelles?
No, you blockhead. Help Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange. Lucas, tell Lucy, Hannah and Dido that I said goodbye and wish them well. And good, obedient husbands when they want them.
These were three housemaids who were particular favourites of Childermas. Davy grinned.
And you yourself willing to do the job, sir? He said.
Childermas laughed, then flinched at the pain in his face.
Well, for Hannah, perhaps, he said. Goodbye, lads.
He shook hands with all of them, and was a little taken aback when Davy, who for all his strength and size was as sentimental as a schoolgirl, insisted on embracing him and actually shed tears. Lucas gave him a bottle of Mr. Norrell's best claret as a parting gift. Childermas led Brewer out of the stables. The moon had risen. He had no difficulty in following the sweep out of the pleasure grounds into the park. He was just crossing over the bridge when the sudden realization came upon him that there was magic going on. It was as if a thousand trumpets had sounded in his ear, or a dazzling light had shone out of the darkness. The world was entirely different from what it had been a moment before. But what that difference was, he could not at first make out. He looked around. Directly above the park and the house, there was a patch of night sky shoved in where it did not belong. The constellations were broken. New stars hung there, stars that Childermas had never seen before. They were, presumably, the stars of Strange's eternal darkness. He took one last look at Hurtview Abbey and galloped away. All the clocks began to strike at the same moment. This in itself was extraordinary enough. For 15 years, Lucas had been trying to persuade the clocks of Hurtview to tell the hour together, and they had never done so until this moment. But what o'clock it might be was hard to say. The clocks struck on and on, long past 12, telling the time of a strange new era.
What in the world is that hideous sound? Asked Lascelles.
Mr. Norrell stood up. He rubbed his hands together. With him always a sign of great nervousness and strain.
Strange is here, he said quickly.
He spoke a word. The clocks were silent.
The door burst open. Mr. Norrell and Mr. Lascelles turned, with faces all alarm, in full expectation of seeing Strange standing there.
But it was only Lucas and two of the other servants.
Mr. Norrell, began Lucas, I think, yes, I know. Go to the storeroom at the foot of the kitchen stairs. In the chest under the window, you will find lead chains, lead padlocks, and lead keys. Bring them here, quickly.
And I will go and fetch a pair of pistols, declared Lascelles.
They will do no good, said Mr. Norrell.
Oh, you would be surprised how many problems a pair of pistols can solve.
They returned within 5 minutes. There was Lucas, looking reluctant and unhappy, holding the chains and locks, Lascelles with his pistols, and 4 or 5 more manservants.
"Where do you suppose he is?" asked Lascelles.
"In the library. Where else?" said Mr. Norrell. "Come."
They left the drawing room and entered the dining room. From here they passed into a short corridor which contained an inlaid ebony sideboard, a marble statue of a centaur and its foal, and a painting of Salome carrying St. John's head on a silver platter. There were 2 doors ahead of them. The one on the right had an unfamiliar look to Lascelles, as if he'd never seen it before. Mr. Norrell led them through it, and they immediately found themselves back in the drawing room.
Wait, said Mr. Norrell in confusion.
He looked behind him.
I must have... No, wait, I have it now. Come.
Once again they passed through the dining room into the corridor. This time they went through the door upon the left. It, too, led straight back to the drawing room. Mr. Norrell gave a loud, despairing cry.
He has broken my labyrinth and woven another against me.
In some ways, sir, remarked Lascelles, I could have wished that you had not taught him so well.
Oh, I never taught him to do this, and you may be sure that he never learnt it from anyone else. Either the devil taught him, or he learnt it this very night in my house. This is the genius of my enemy. Lock a door against him, and all that happens is that he learns first how to pick a lock, and second, how to build a better one against you.
Lucas and the other servants lit more candles, as if light could somehow help them see through Strange's spells, and help them distinguish reality from magic. Soon, each of the 3 apartments was ablaze with light. Candlesticks and candelabras were crowded upon every surface. But it only served to confuse them more. They went from dining room to drawing room, from drawing room to corridor.
Like foxes in a stopped earth, said Lascelles.
But try as they might, they could not leave the 3 apartments.
Time passed.
It was impossible to say how much. The clocks had all turned to midnight. Every window showed the black of eternal night and the unknown stars. Mr. Norrell stopped walking. He closed his eyes. His face was as dark and tight as a fist. He stood quite still, and only his lips moved slightly. Then he opened his eyes briefly and said,
"Follow me."
Closing his eyes again, he walked. It was as if he were following the plan of an entirely different house that had somehow got wedged inside his own. The turns he took, the rights and lefts, made a new path, one he had never taken before. After 3 or 4 minutes, he opened his eyes. There before him was the corridor he had been searching for, the one with the floor of stone flags, and at the end of it, the tall, shadowy shape of the library door.
"Now we shall see what he is doing," he cried.
"Lucas, keep the lead chains and locks ready. There is no better prophylactic against magic than lead. We'll bind his hands, and that will hinder him a little. Mr. Lascelles, how quickly do you suppose we might get a letter to one of the ministers?"
He was a little surprised that none of them made any reply, and so he turned. He was quite alone. A little way off, he heard Lascelles say something. His cold, languid voice was unmistakable. He heard one of the other servants reply, and then Lucas. But gradually all the noise grew less. The sounds of the servants rushing from room to room were gone. There was silence.
Chapter 64. 2 versions of Lady Pole. Mid-February, 1817.
"Well," said Lascelles, "that was unexpected."
He and the servants were gathered at the north wall of the dining room, a wall through which Mr. Norrell had just walked with all the composure in the world. Lascelles put out his hand and touched it. It was perfectly solid. He pressed it hard. It did not move.
"Did he mean to do that, do you think?"
wondered one of the servants.
"I do not think it matters much what he meant," said Lucas. "He has gone to be with Mr. Strange now."
"Which is as much as to say he has gone to the devil," added Lascelles.
"What will happen now?"
asked another servant. No one answered him.
Images of magical battles flitted through the minds of everyone present. Mr. Norrell hurling mystical cannonballs at Strange. Strange calling up devils to come and carry Mr. Norrell away. They listened for sounds of a struggle. There were none. A shout came from the next room. One of the servants had opened the drawing-room door and found the breakfast room on the other side of it. Beyond the breakfast room was Mr. Norrell's sitting-room, and beyond that, his dressing-room. The old sequence of rooms was suddenly re-established. The labyrinth was broken. The relief of this discovery was very great. The servants immediately abandoned Lascelles and went down to the kitchen, the natural refuge and solace of their class. Lascelles, just as naturally, sat down in solitary state in Mr. Norrell's sitting-room. He had some idea of staying there until Mr. Norrell returned, or, if Mr. Norrell never came back, of waiting for Strange and then shooting him. After all, he thought, what can a magician do against a lead ball? Between the pistol firing and his heart exploding, there is no time for magic. But such thoughts as these provided only a temporary comfort. The house was too silent, the darkness too magical. He was too aware of the servants gathered together sociably in one place, and the two magicians doing God knew what in another place, and himself alone in a third place. There was an old long-case clock that stood in one corner of the room, a last remnant of Mr. Norrell's childhood home in York. This clock had, like all the others in the house, turned to midnight when Strange arrived. But it had not done so willingly. It protested very volubly against such an unexpected turn of events. Its ticking was all askew. It seemed to be drunk, or possibly in a fever. And from time to time it made a sound that was remarkably like an indrawn breath. And every time it did so, Lascelles thought that Strange had entered the room and was about to say something. He got up and followed the servants to the kitchen. The kitchen at Hertfew Abbey was very much like the undercroft of a great church, full of classical angles and classical gloom. In the centre of the room was a huge number of tallow candles, and gathered there was every servant that Lascelles had ever seen at Hertfew, and a great many that he had not. He leant against a pillar at the top of a flight of steps. Lucas glanced up at him. He said, "We've been discussing what to do, sir. We shall leave within the half hour. We can do Mr. Norrell no good by staying here, and may do ourselves some harm. That is our intention, sir, but if you have another opinion, I shall be glad to hear it." "My opinion?" exclaimed Lascelles. He looked all amazement, and only part of it was feigned. "This is the first time I was ever asked my opinion by a footman. Thank you. But I believe I shall decline my share of this, he thought for a moment, before settling upon the most offensive word in his vocabulary. "Democracy."
"As you wish, sir," said Lucas mildly.
"It must be daylight in England by now,"
said one of the maids, looking longingly at the windows set high in the walls.
"This is England, silly girl," declared Lascelles.
"No, sir, begging your pardon," said Lucas, "but it is not. England is a natural place. Davy, how long to turn the horses out?"
"Oh," cried Lascelles, "you're all very bold, I must say, to discuss your thievery in front of me. What, you think I shall not speak out against you? On the contrary, I shall see you all hanged."
Some of the servants nervously eyed the pistols in Lascelles' hands. Lucas, however, ignored him. The servants soon agreed that those among them who had relations or friends in the neighbourhood would go to them. The rest would be dispatched with the horses to the various farms which stood upon Mr. Norrell's estate.
"So you see, sir," said Lucas to Lascelles, "nobody is stealing. Nobody is a thief. All of Mr. Norrell's property is to remain on Mr. Norrell's land, and will take as good care of his horses as if they were still in his stables. But it will be a wicked cruelty to leave any creature in this perpetual darkness."
Some time later, the servants left Hertfew. There was no saying exactly how much later it was. Their pocket watches, like the clocks, had all turned to midnight. With baskets and valises slung over their arms and knapsacks on their backs, they led the horses by the halter. There were also two donkeys, and a goat who had always lived in the stables because the horses found him agreeable company. Lascelles followed at a distance. He had no desire to appear part of this rag-tag and bobtail procession, but neither did he want to be left alone in the house. 10 yards short of the river, they walked out of the darkness into the dawn. There was a sudden rush of scents upon the air, scents of frost, winter earth, and the nearby river. The colours and shapes of the park seemed simplified, as if England had been made afresh during the night. To the poor servants,
who had been in some doubt whether they would ever see anything but dark and stars again, the sight was an exceedingly welcome one. Their watches had started up again, and they found by a general consultation that it was 7:45. But the alarms of that night were not quite over yet. Two bridges now led across the river, where only one had been before. Lascelles came hurrying up. "What is that?" he demanded, pointing at the new bridge. An old servant, a man with a beard like a miniature white cloud stuck to the end of his chin, said that it was a fairy bridge. He had seen it in his youth. It had been built long ago when John Usglas still ruled Yorkshire. It had fallen into disrepair and been dismantled in the time of Mr. Norrell's uncle. "And yet here it is, back again," said Lucas with a shudder.
"And what lies on the other side?" asked Lascelles.
The old servant said that it led to Northallerton once upon a time, by way of various queer places.
"Does it meet up with the road we saw near the Red House?" asked Lascelles.
The old servant shook his head. He did not know. Lucas was losing patience. He wished to be away. "Fairy roads are not like Christian roads," he said. "Often they do not go where they're supposed to at all. But what does it matter? Nobody here is going to put so much as a foot upon the wicked thing."
"Thank you," said Lascelles, "but I believe I shall make up my own mind upon that point."
He hesitated a moment, then strode forward onto the fairy bridge. Several of the servants called out to him to come back.
"Oh, let him go," cried Lucas, tightening his hold upon a basket which contained his cat. "Let him be damned if he wishes. I'm sure no one could deserve it more."
He threw Lascelles one last hearty look of dislike and followed the others into the park. Behind them, the black pillar rose up into the grey Yorkshire sky, and the end of it could not be seen.